I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast and conversation with authors of recent books in political theory and social political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Kevin Balier, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Bowling Green State University. We're discussing his 2021 book, Trust in a Polarized Age, Oxford University Press. Balier works on contemporary liberalism, especially issues in politics, philosophy, and economics, as well as politics and religion. He is the author of two previous books and many articles. Good. Well, Kevin Balier, welcome back on the Political Theory Review.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's good to see you again, Kevin. And I enjoyed reading really the sequel to the previous book that we talked about. It's a persuasive, cogently argued book. And one of the things that's really impressive about it, how it synthesizes so much literature from so many different fields, right? So you're from a philosophy, you have a philosophy background, teaching philosophy department, but really synthesizing political science literature, economics literature in a way that that advances your argument. So it's really impressive stuff. So thanks for it. Let me just start by asking you to talk about the motivation for writing the book.
Sure. So, I mean, I've been thinking about the foundations of kind of liberal open societies for a long time. And a lot of my early work was on the role of religion in a kind of liberal open society. And then, you know, from there, I started to think, well, you know, why am I a liberal? Why do I support this sort of broad range of individual and group liberties protected in a constitution, governed by the rule of law, democracy, and so on? Why do I like markets? Why do I like some features of the welfare state? You know, what would sort of tie these things together? And part of the answer from the kind of liberalism I hail from, which is called public reason liberalism, is that the advantage of a liberal regime and its institutions is they can be justified to multiple perspectives. So, you know, I hate using the term neutrality because red flags go up in people's minds, but the thought is roughly that liberal institutions are unique in that they can be justified to multiple perspectives. The diverse people can get on board with it. But then the question was like, what good comes of public justification? Suppose our institutions are justified to multiple perspectives. What have we got? You know, what comes out of that? But one common thing is respect for persons, right? That like we respect the dignity of people by justifying things to them. But I always found those arguments unpersuasive because respect requires lots of different things, and those different things have to be weighed against each other. And also, I'm not sure how much respect requires any behavior independent of social context or relationships. Another thing people say is that it achieves stability. But they always mean a kind of moralized stability. Like they want it to be stable for the right reasons. Well, then what are the right reasons? You know, what are those moral reasons? What do they consist in? As I was working through my late advisor, Jerry Gauss's work, one of the things he talks about a lot is what he calls moral relations between persons. So things like love, friendship, and trust. So these are relationships where not only that we value, but they involve the assignment, at least implicitly, of certain kinds of duties and rights, where we think there are certain things we owe those that we have moral relationships with. There are certain things that we owe our friends. Now, hopefully in good friendships and good romantic relationships, those never come up, right? But they're in the background, right? That there's a certain kind of morality internal to the kind of relationships that we want to have with people. And a lot of public reason liberals have tried to ground public reason in civic friendship in order to sort of make use of that kind of insight. But I think friendship is too intimate a relation in large, diverse societies. So I thought, okay, well, what's a thinner moral relation that we could actually have? Oh, trust. Well, trust seems kind of intimate. Like, what is this trust between like two people or whatever? It turns out political scientists and economists have for decades been talking about another kind of trust, social trust. That is the faith that we have in strangers that they'll follow established norms. And then it turned out, oh, wow, so I care about trust. And now we know a reason to care about public justification. We want to maintain trust because we think those kind of relationships have a kind of intrinsic value. But there's all this empirical literature on the kinds of instrumental benefits that social trust has. And so I thought if public justification brings about social trust, we could give a very good rationale for it, and then the kind of liberalism that it grounds, right? So there's kind of two steps in the argument. One is to give this kind of argument for liberalism that it can be justified to different perspectives, and then say, well, why does that matter? Because it helps to sustain relations of social trust, and everyone ought to care about that for intrinsic or for instrumental reasons. So then I started to study the literature on social trust, develop a concept of social trust based on the philosophical literature, try to line that up with the empirical literatures, and lo and behold, I started to go, find that at least some, but not all, liberal institutions are correlated with different kinds of trust, either social trust or, so say, trust in government or certain kinds of institutions. Now, the other question came up, we've got a correlation between some of them. Some things there's no correlation, like free speech measures and social trust don't correlate at all, negatively or positively, which was sad. Freedom of religion doesn't either. So in the book, I only talk about those for which there was some both correlation and plausible causal relationships that people had brought up in the literature. Okay. So the thought was, okay, well, do these liberal institutions create trust between diverse perspectives in the real world, right? Because then you could say, oh, wow, I mean, they're not only morally justified, right? They're justified to different perspectives, but they generate real goods in practice. And so that provides a very powerful argument for liberalism, because we've got both the principled argument, which I gave in the first book, and then we have the practical arguments, which I give in the second book. So that's kind of how I arrived at where I was. I thought, oh, wow, if liberalism is the sort of thing that sustains social trust and trust in government, then, and I can show that empirically, that would be a really cool thing to do. So that's what I'm kind of trying to add to the liberal tradition, is to integrate in a very direct way the study of social and political trust into the theory of what liberalism is and how it's justified and so on.
Yeah, that's great. And thanks for, I was going to ask you the relationship between the first and the second book, but it's helpful to sort of lay it out there that, the first book was the sort of lays out the philosophical principles about trust properly understood or properly justified, whereas this is, trust as it's actually established in the real, in by the institutions of liberal governance. So we'll talk about go through some of the main institutions that you talk about in the book. But first I wanted to just sort of touch on, the first point to make, I think, was, I found very helpful your sort of framing, the way that you framed the book in terms of the breakdown of trust in America, which I think needs to be emphasized, which I think really expresses the real need for this book in terms of the polarization that's growing in America. I think it's helpful to have that in the background, because this is a book that's sorely needed. But I thought what you could do maybe, because you could talk a little bit about what you mean by trust, what the concept of social trust is, and the concept of political trust that you also use, and you derive it from these from the empirical literatures. So how do these empirical literatures understand it, operationalize it, measure it?
Good. So a huge part of the project was bringing together the philosophical literature on trust and ethics, and then the political science and economics literatures. So there's a huge amount of synthetic work. So I tried to develop a concept that I thought was true to the philosophical literature, but that also plausibly captured what was going on in the measures in the empirical literature. And I worked pretty hard on that. I don't know if I've got it, but I thought, boy, was this worth a try. So the way I think about, I'll just start with interpersonal trust, just trust between me and you. Trust is a kind of reliance, right? So when I trust someone, I make myself vulnerable to them. I'm depending on them to achieve some goal or aim or a series of aims, even just having a relationship with them. And I depend on them to engage in certain lines of conduct in order to facilitate my goals. But trust is more than reliance, right? So, I mean, I can rely on my car, I can rely on my computer. So what do we add to reliance to get trust? Well, what we add to reliance to get trust is what P.F. Strawson called the participant stance. That is, we see people as moral agents and that have the kinds of relationships that ground what he called the reactive attitudes, of things like resentment, indignation, and guilt, which are responses to certain kinds of perceived moral wrongs. So resentment, I feel when I feel you have wronged me, indignation when I observe wrongdoing that wasn't directed at me, and guilt when I recognize my own wrongdoing. So we might say very roughly that trust is a kind of moralized reliance, that I rely on people in a way that can be disappointed or betrayed. That is the sort of reliance that there's an implicit expectation that I not violate on pain of moral wrongdoing. There's more to it than that, but that's the sort of essence of trust. It's a kind of moralized reliance. When I depend on people and there's some people as moral agents, right? And not just as objects or, you know, tools or implements. Okay, so then what's social trust? Well, the thing about social trust is it's trust in strangers. And then the question becomes, well, how do we trust people we don't know? And what do we trust them to do? And what do political scientists think that we trust people to do? And if you drill down into the literature, it isn't always clear, because they'll ask survey questions like, can most people be trusted, or can you never be too careful in dealing with people, or like most people honest, or things like that. So what I tried to do was bring in the social norms literature from economics and political science. Social norms are rules or patterns of conduct, but they aren't like conventions, like driving on the right-hand side of the road, where we expect, you know, you follow them out of your self-interest. So these are norms that we think that others ought to follow, and that we think others think that we ought to follow, right? So things like keeping our promises, right? That's a social norm. It isn't always in my interest to keep my promises, but it's something that I think others think that I ought to do. That is, there are patterns of behavior that people in my community generally expect me to follow and think I ought to follow. So think about, for instance, driving someone, right? You don't know who's in other cars. You may never encounter them again, but there are social norms that govern the use of the roads. It isn't all law and convention. Things like, you know, your politeness to other people at a four-way stop, or you're letting people merge into oncoming traffic. So those are cases where we have large anonymous interactions, but they're moralized, right? We think there are social norms at play, and there are social norms that we rely on people to follow. We need people to let us merge into oncoming traffic.
Yeah, road rage is a good expression.
It is the reactive attitude that responds to violations. Yeah. So social trust is when we rely on representative strangers to comply with central social norms that we depend on people to follow to achieve our most basic goals. Things like not lying, not stealing, not killing, not defrauding. Those kinds of norms. So we have high social trust when we think we can rely on most people in our society to comply with those norms most of the time. And we have less social trust when we're less confident, right? We think, oh, the police are corrupt, right? Or like most people steal, or, you know, you can, again, never be too careful in dealing with people because you don't know what they're going to do. Now, I think that ends up lining up with the measures. Because a lot of the different kinds of survey measures are tied to central social norms like honesty. So I tried to sort of say, well, okay, social trust is a kind of trust as understood in the philosophical literature, but it also seems to measure, line up with the survey measures. Okay, so like how is it measured? The main way that social trust is measured is with cross-national surveys. So they're oftentimes regional surveys, like the Eurobarometer measures trust across European countries. And the standard trust question that's been asked for decades is, you know, can most people be trusted, or can you never be too careful in dealing with people? And then they have like yes, no. But over the years, things have gotten a lot more sophisticated, right? They have like 11-point scales, and now they ask a series of other questions. And you might think, oh, wow, that's kind of rough survey measure. But the external validity of the measure has been challenged, and I think it survived challenge. So for instance, people's responses on the surveys predict wallet return behavior. So they're tightly correlated with, like, you know, do people return wallets when they're left behind? So it does actually seem to correlate pretty strongly with people's actual behavior. They're not just making things up to pollsters. And it seems to be pretty darn cross-cultural too. There is a kind of small meta-literatures on trust attacking the measure, attacking its cultural applicability, and so on and so forth. But I think it's held up pretty well. Economists also measure trust with what they call trust games in the lab. They're kind of prisoner's dilemma played in sequence, where I can offer to cooperate and then you can respond or defect. Your incentive is to defect, but You'll get more for yourself, but then it turns out, oh, most people don't defect. And that's seen as being a kind of trust behavior and me making a cooperative offer to you, and trustworthiness behavior when I decide whether to respond cooperatively or not. So people, you know, economists try to measure it with trust games in the lab. And for a while, there was this fight between them, and there still kind of is, about what's the better measure, you know, the laboratory behavior or the surveys. And it turns out at low stakes, there isn't a great correlation between the two. But as the stakes of the trust game go up, you start to see more correlation between the measures. So there doesn't seem to be a really hard contrast in the findings in the lab and the findings in the surveys. Okay, so that's where you get the philosophy, and then that's what's going on in political, the rest of the stuff is what's going on in political science and economics. There's a kind of what we call PPE kind of fit. Hard to summarize three fields quickly, but that's my best.
No, that was great. That was great. I mean, I particularly like the, you know, those economics games, because sometimes that, you know, I'm skeptical of people self-reporting of these kinds of measures.
Yep.
So I mean, I have some memory of reading somewhere about, yeah, maybe it was either the dictator or the ultimatum game, and the ways in which actually Western societies, I think it was one of these cross national.
They tend to be more cooperative with strangers.
So in a dictator game where you give $100 and you can give between zero and $100 to the other person, you know, standard self-interest would predict you'd give zero. But it turns out that, I mean, maybe you know this, I don't even remember what the data was, but Western society, you know, capitalist societies tend to give way more than less developed societies.
One other thing that goes on is the rational choice dictates that no matter what you give the other person, they should accept it. Because if you don't get an agreement, you both get nothing. And in many, like sort of certain kinds of tribal societies, people will respond in precisely that way. Mm-hmm. But in Western societies, people will turn down small offers because they think they're unfair. And I think also because they think the person is not very trustworthy. And so they'll punish people for behaving badly, and people that don't even know. So for instance, in many like sort of societies that are more, have more particularized trust, you'll play cooperatively with your in-group, with your family and your clan, but you don't really cooperate at all with strangers or people from another clan or tribe. But in open market societies where people have to cooperate with strangers all the time, they are a lot more cooperative. And it looks like actually market societies arise in cultures first that were already more conducive to high levels of social trust. Now, this gets into the interesting new work, or it's not so new, but it's a new book by Joe Henrich, called The Weirdest People in the World. Mm-hmm. And so WEIRD is an acronym meaning Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. And he points out that these cultures are very different, in part because they have very high levels of social trust and trust in informal institutions. So most people throughout most of history are going to trust their tribe or in-group because of repeat interactions, you know, but they don't interact much with other groups, right? They're in villages or they're in hunter-gatherer bands or something like that. So how did societies develop the ability to trust people they don't know? Well, it's pretty a weird story. So it turns out that the Catholic Church, and to a lesser extent, the Orthodox Church in the medieval period, started to ban cousin marriage. And then they started to ban second cousin marriage. And then they started to ban third and fourth, and even up to 1.6 cousin marriage. So you can't keep a clan together under those conditions because they require a certain degree of cousin marriage. So what happens is, oddly, the Catholic Church destroys the family. And so you're left with a nuclear family. Well, guess what? When it gets cold in a society of nuclear families, it's going to go bad for them. You know, the lone the lone wolf dies, the lone nuclear family dies, but the pack survives. To paraphrase George R. R. Martin in Game of Thrones. So what happens is that particularly societies with one very cold month tend to still be very highly socially trusting, because if they couldn't trust strangers, they would die. So these societies developed the ability to socially trust because it was necessary. So there's a kind of selection effect. So, but what happens is that those societies are able to develop informal institutions first. You know, places like the Netherlands, England, you know, Sweden, and so on. And then other societies can come to copy those institutions.
Right. But
they work more or less well in different kinds of societies. So you develop social trust first out of necessity, the necessity of trusting strangers, because there's this weird effect in that the Catholic hierarchy decided to discourage cousin marriage, producing the nuclear family for the first time. Father, mother, and a couple of kids. So that's Henrik's theory of where social trust came from. Now, there needs to be a lot more data on this in terms of how do people psychologically learn to socially trust, which is one of the things I'm going to be working on next. But the thought here was that people, formal institutions like markets and democratic government require a great deal of trust in strangers, right? Because if you want to interact with people you never see again, you need some social trust. If you want to be in a democratic society with people, you have to trust the people that you lose to. Right. So the societies that developed these institutions first were ones that I think, in my view, needed to already be socially trusting. So in my view, social trust actually tends to be a cause rather than an effect. And there are some institutions that can move it a little bit. But the main thing liberal institutions do is they're in many ways the product of high social trust, but they can produce high levels of trust in government and they can increase social trust in turn. But we don't really know how much. So I think, you know, social trust is usually a cause. But sometimes it's an effect.
Okay, yeah.
And that's the kind of story that Henrik tells.
Yeah, that's good.
Why it's the cause.
That's in a way sort of my high-level question just before we launch into the different institutions was, you know, which way the causal arrow goes. So that's helpful to hear.
Yeah.
So it is the case that, you know, on your view, you know, social trust is a precondition and gives rise to these institutions. But, you know, how much do these institutions then, and just to be clear about what institutions we're going to be talking about, so civil society, free market, this democratic constitutionalism, free and fair elections. I mean, so how much do those then institutions reciprocally, you know, cause increased social trust? I mean, is this a sort of virtuous cycle that we're talking about? Or, you know, how do you think, just at a high level?
There's a high trust equilibrium and a low trust equilibrium. So, you know, yes, trust has feedback effects. Social trust has feedback effects. And so so I don't think social trust is genetic. But it also doesn't change very much. That's the worrisome thing about the United States is it's going down. Most countries, it's very, very stable. But it's not genetic. It will go down like at the borders with a lower trust country. People will be lower trust. There's some kind of interaction effect, but it's a tight equilibrium. And it's very mysterious how it works. And so we don't know how it happens. I think it's passed on from children watching how their parents interact with strangers. I don't know if you have kids, but you know, someone comes over to visit and the kids don't know them and they kind of hide behind you or hide behind the couch and they're watching you, right? And if you run away from them or kick them out, like they're going to be scared. But if you say, oh no, it's fine. It's just your mom or it's just your aunt or whatever. So what happens is it's a lot of the transmissions of family culture and family culture in many ways can be pretty stable with respect to that variable.
Yeah, this is under COVID conditions. This is interesting because my 2-year-old who spent more than most of her life under COVID conditions, in which everybody's afraid of one another. I could see that. She's more afraid than my older child of strangers. Yeah.
It could hurt the whole world. I mean, when we start to see the trust data with COVID, I'm not looking forward to it. What happens is that it looks like trust is built in impressionable years, probably going up to late teens, then it tends to harden after that. So you look at Swedish immigrants, the young ones, when they immigrate to lower trust countries, there aren't many higher trust countries, Norway basically. And when they go to lower trust countries, the younger they are, the more their trust levels will adjust to their region. So particularly when Swedes go to Brazil, you go from 65% of people say most can be trusted to 5%. But if they're over 30, it didn't change at all. You know, what you want is people to have positive interactions with strangers when they're younger. Mm-hmm. And this is part of the mechanism, I think, for political interactions, treatment by government officials, treatment by commercial partners, and treatment within civic organizations, and then how those civic organizations interface with the public.
Yeah, so
you can have isolated associates. Yeah. So a lot of it depends on positive contact experiences.
Right. Yeah,
that's a lot of it. Now, there are all kinds of other mediated effects that are very complicated, but that's part of the story, is positive contact experiences. But there's other things that are quite complicated causal relationships.
Yeah. No, and I mean, one of the things I'm just trying to get nailed down here is, you know, sort of what the situation here, how bad is it in America? You know, back to the motivating the book point. I mean, so we've been talking about trust. Yeah. You know, how much has actually trust declined? I mean, you were saying that a lot of countries it's stable over time, but I get the sense
that almost every country.
Right, but the US has declined.
Yeah. So what's interesting about this is that there are some countries where social trust has declined more over the last 20, 30 years, but they're all countries that are newly democratic. So their trust levels have gone down since they were non-democratic. Romania, Spain, because the numbers go back a ways, Chile, I'm trying to think of the other two. We don't know exactly why that is, but there's a couple of different theories. But among established democracies, the United States is the only country where social trust is going down in a statistically significant way. And it's gone down from the 60s until today, from over half the population saying those can be trusted to now about a third. That's a very, very large drop for social trust.
Yeah.
Political trust can vary. Trust in government, you know, do you trust the government in Washington or whatever? That can vary a lot. But the social trust has been a not entirely steady decline. A lot of it was going on more in the 60s and the 70s, but there's been declines since then. I mean, 2018, we were at 31%.
Mm-hmm. From a high of, do you remember what the high?
55% in the early 60s, the data we have from the earliest data from the American National Election Survey. Now that didn't make it into this book because I didn't have the American National Election data. I just had the General Social Survey, which doesn't go back as far. But yeah, since the early 60s, it looks like about a 20 point decline, a little bit more, which is, it's staggering. It's just not, I mean, we don't have measures of social trust in these other countries in the 60s and 70s. Most of the trust levels started being measured in 1980, but even since then, we're the only country with a really steep decline.
Right.
And we're also the only country with a really big increase in political polarization. There's one country that gotten more politically polarized, but its trust levels haven't moved very much or gone up. That's Switzerland.
Right.
But almost every other country, like they're not polarized and their trust has gone up, or they become less polarized and their trust has gone up. So we're the only major country, with the partial exception of Switzerland, established democracy, where social trust is going down and political polarization is going up. And no one had tried to tie those things together. But it seemed to me like they were probably related. And so we're working on the correlation now, which seems to be there, but then we've got to tell some causal stories. And so part of my story in the book is that we're in a distrust polarization, or I call divergence in the book, loop. So trust falls, polarization rises, and they make each other worse. And here's how it goes. You're developing new in-group, out-group phenomena with polarization. And that's lowering your beliefs in the morality and trustworthiness of the other side. So polarization lowers social trust because it creates tribes, which is exactly the thing that allowed us to develop. Well, overcoming tribalism was how we developed social trust in the first place. But lower trust can drive more political polarization, right? Because you don't trust people as much. Then you know you're less interested in cooperating with them. You're more suspicious of them, and you're going to rely more on your group and think good things about your group and bad things about the other group. So more polarization can lower trust. Lower trust can increase polarization. So I think that's part of what's going on. And I think the other explanations that are given, like immigration, it just doesn't work. Increased economic inequality, I think, is more of an effect of social trust than a cause. I disagree with most trust researchers on that, but I think the evidence is actually pretty strong. So the main other explanations just don't amount to much, but no one's really tried to show that the connection between polarization and social trust. Political trust is a different story. So polarization does seem to increase or decrease trust in government, and unless your people are in power. So it makes it vary a lot. So we're trying to verify this empirically right now. I've got a co-author that I'm working with, but compiling all the election survey data And then matching it up with all the trust data is proving to be sort of complicated. But I think, you know, it's a plausible prima facie case that they're interacting. And I talk about a lot of the evidence in the introduction. And, you know, I give an example now, since, you know, this year began with the January 6th rioters. So you don't get this without both low trust and high polarization. If these people were just low trust, but not polarized, they would have just said, oh, you can't trust anybody, even Trump. So I'm not going to show up. Right. But if they're highly polarized, but they're not low trust, then, you know, there are a lot of like the polarized people at home. You know, they trust the news media and they're like, OK, Trump actually lost. Right. So if you have low trust and high polarization, then that creates a really big potential problem. Like, you know, an insurrection that got people killed. So that's the kind of nasty thing that can happen when you, the toxic mix of low trust and high polarization. But I do think they're related, and I think they jointly explain some things that we see.
Yeah, so let's shift over to talk about the different institutions that you talk about in the meat of the book. Because I'm interested in, you know, sort of walking through some of these to see how, in your view, you know, greater attention to these institutions can address some of these problems. So maybe just to start with civil society, where you start in the freedom of association, that, you know, as you lay it out, the freedom of association, free civil society increases social trust, right? I'm one of the, maybe you just sort of, you know, talk through exactly why that is.
So it's complicated.
Yeah, okay, right, go ahead.
It's heavily disputed. Okay, so Robert Putnam did this stuff a couple of decades ago saying, oh, like being involved in civil associations a lot seems to increase social trust. And there did seem to be a correlation. And then like within a few decades, everyone just thought, no, high trusters are high joiners. So if you trust people a lot, you'll join associations, otherwise not. So there is a correlation, but Putnam got the explanation wrong.
Right, the arrow went the other way. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, like I co-author with some guys that are like, just think this is obvious. This is Putnam has been completely refuted. But I think there are two factors obscuring obscuring us from detecting correlation. First, we're looking at people as a whole and we're not looking at people in their impressionable years. So I think if you grow up in an association and you have positive interactions with others that you don't necessarily know, that ought to be trust building just based on just the positive interaction and impressionable years seeming to have something to do with trust. But here's another thing that's key, is it doesn't distinguish between isolated and more interconnected associations. So there's some associations where you only interact with people like in your church and then they're like very afraid of other people. And those can be trust reducing. But if you have associations that actually interact, like your church does charitable work with people in the inner city, right? So you're 19 and you're at a soup kitchen. Like, I think that we have good reason to think that that's trust increasing. So my claim is that, yeah, for adults, high trusters are high joiners, but when younger people are involved in those associations, the positive interactions can increase social trust. The difficulty is that in the isolated associations might reduce it. So the case for freedom of association empirically is kind of dicey because it supports interactive organizations. So I do think, and I don't think this is a liberal, that governments can give incentives for associations to interact more with the world. And they already pretty much do, right, with tax breaks for charitable work. So the idea is that, you know, you can encourage, I think, in a liberal way, associations to interact more with others. And I think that will make the trust effects clearer. But I think if you disaggregated the kinds of associations and then the ages of the people in them, that it would come out more clearly. So that's what I have to say about that. But in that case, the correlation and the causal story I want to tell is the second weakest of the five, because elections are actually, there is a correlation and a good causal story, but it's the weakest. It's the weakest correlation.
Okay, good. Yeah, because that's interesting to hear, because my worry about this one out of your different institutions is, I guess, precisely what we were talking about a minute ago, which is the sort of the rise in polarization in American politics, say, and which is, you know, the result we have of freedom of association. You can associate with anyone you want, including nutty organizations, right?
And yep.
that themselves create further polarization and further undermine trust, right? You can be part of a QAnon group if you wanted, you know. I mean, not to mention the points that say a Charles Murray or a later career Robert Putnam would make about the sorting that goes on among the classes, that you have sort of mating among higher status, higher income individuals, yep. which leaves behind sort of, so you have a yawning gap between a higher class and a lower class. It creates a sort of bubble within that.
Pandemics made it worse too.
Yeah, right. And I would expect this to sort of decrease trust rather than, so I guess what I'm getting at, what I want to ask you, Kevin, is sort of, isn't this an area where government should maybe put more of its thumb on the scale? I mean, I'm thinking of, policies like national service, which has been floated enough, which is the idea to create, a form of association that will cut across the bubbles and force people to interact more to get to. Go ahead.
Yeah. So that's going to violate the public justification constraint. So what you're looking is to create trust in for the right reasons, which I understand is, people can see for themselves from their own perspective the reason to do it. And there's a whole lot of people, I think, that have really strong objections to national service. And so forcing people to be involved is just going to undermine relations of trust with their government. So you have to pursue policies that are either not coercive or that whose coercion can be justified to multiple perspectives. So I think, for instance, tax breaks the churches aren't getting taxed, but some kind of subsidies for charitable work, right? That's something that's good. But there's other policies that are very liberal that actually would get people to associate across economic classes more, which is real estate reform, which is something I am all over, which is that a lot of what increases inequality is that you get the richer people living in the richer neighborhoods and they benefit from the local zoning for single family homes in particular. So I think that there should be state level reforms. We're not doing real estate at the city level because it's keeping poor people out of San Francisco unless they want to be homeless, or LA. And what happens then is that richer people's housing prices housing wealth will decline. So there'll be more economic equality, right? Someone can build a double family home right next to them. It'll drive people nuts. They'll fight it really hard, but it will reduce inequality, but it'll also increase growth because now workers can live in cities and instead of making $10 an hour, they can make 25, right? And they can also extend the division of labor within cities. So they can make it so it's easier for people from the country to move into the city. And they'll have higher, they'll be a lot more productive and they'll make those companies more productive. So what you want is broad-based economic growth, growth that includes everybody, which can help trust, but it also should help because, maybe rich people and poor people will live a little closer together. And a lot of the benefits of a sort of mating, of being able to be involved in I guess people could still form these private little areas, but national legal apparatus, particularly New York and California, would stop exacerbating inequality to the same radical degree. And it would stop exacerbating people's ability to just not interact with each other. I also think I don't say this in the book, but I also think school vouchers will help with this because residential zoning determines school level. And if you have vouchers, you can decouple school value from home values. So everything is dysfunction is bound up with the corrupt way in which we zone things that redistribute wealth from the poor to the rich. Because, they say, look, you can't live in cities because I want my home to be worth $1 million. People don't think about it like that, but that's exactly what's going on. And so I think what will happen is you're going to end up with less segregated neighborhoods because people from poor minority groups are going to come in and have a dual family home next to your home. And a lot of people aren't going to like that, but I don't care. Because they need to get used to it because we're a diverse society. So, if you have a, first generation, Hispanic immigrants who build a dual family home next to you, and you're a third generation, lovely assortative mating, both got your jobs from Ivy League. I mean, I think just to sound a little bit like a liberal perfectionist, but you could talk about the good in political liberalism, that would be good for them. Right? I mean, it'd be good for rich and poor to interact. So there are things that we can do that are liberal that will increase interaction. So we have to be very careful to abide by policies where the coercion can be justified to multiple perspectives. You say, well, for the rich people, how's the coercion justified? Well, this is a decrease in coercion, not an increase. So it's not an issue. It's the rich people being coercive, right? It's the real estate boards being coercive. They're saying you can't build here, you can't live here, right? So that's the idea is, and one of the proposals I support is I think California and New York and other states, they ought to real estate zone at the state level. And the reason they ought to do that is it's harder to capture those institutions for local rich people to do it. And they have an incentive as states to zone in a more economically efficient way to increase their tax haul. So the idea is if the state of California can zone so that poor workers can live in San Francisco, and that creates higher tax revenues because it increases productivity, at least they have an incentive to do it. So, but I think that's all within the liberal toolkit. But okay. I'm all over housing reform. I mean, I think that would be huge for lots of reasons.
No, and that's fair enough. I mean, that's a way in which it's not a good example for my side of things, because it's not actually a good freedom of association. You know, when you have zoning, you don't have a good form of freedom of association, because you can't contract.
It's not freedom.
Right? So you need actually more freedom.
It's unfree association.
What about the other example I sort of lumped together there. I mean, the example of the, you know, freedom of association on the internet. I mean, it's sort of Wild West out there. And I mean, what about regulation of the internet? I mean, we were talking about the move away from thinking about Facebook and so forth as just sort of neutral content providers towards more regulatory approach to them, because it does seem, I mean, it just sort of, again, you know, bigger picture here, seems like freedom of association on the internet might be a contributor to rising mistrust rather than contributing to greater.
Yeah, mistrust. I mean, we don't have great data on this, but what I have seen suggests that actually cable news might be the worst. Facebook may not be so bad, because like at least you see like your uncle is voting for Trump or something, you know, like at least like you're more likely to encounter a little bit of difference. The thing I haven't really thought through is how to think about restructuring the tech companies from within a public reason framework. Because a lot of the tech companies' property rights aren't like physical property or human capital, where things, you know, well, you can't interfere with people's human capital because it's like in their brains, but you can interfere with like the physical stuff in certain kinds of respects, or financial stuff. But as far as like regulating these companies so that they don't create these really nasty cultures, I'm not sure. So here's something I've been thinking about from my friend Ryan Muldoon, where a lot of the cancel culture nastiness comes from Twitter. Start there. And the reason is it's costless to socially punish. And so because of the technology, you get these huge pile-ons that are really, really, really cheap. Right. And then, you know, everybody goes nuts, and then, you know, they all start petitioning Disney or something to get someone fired or something like that. Some of this stuff might be able to be fixed algorithmically. So you say to Twitter, you know, you come up with an algorithm to at least roughly delineate which tweets are social punishment. And then people have to pay a cent to do it. And so the people who are sitting around engaging in social punishment all day, there's some kind of cost they have to pay. Maybe it doesn't monetary. Maybe it's something like they only get so many social punishments per month, condemnations. So you may say, well, that's a restriction of free speech. Well, it was within a tech apparatus, right? And a company that has enormous political and social power. So I've been trying to think through, like, you could reduce the Twitter pylons, and a lot of these like viral cancellations you could reduce, because that was a huge amount of polarization, I think, that's driven by this sort of sense that cancellation is unfair or it doesn't happen enough or something like that. So there are questions. Are there regulations of the tech companies? Well, the main thing I think that would help is to reduce the amount of social punishment. Another thing that I think would help is actually having these Silicon Valley guys doing less of the regulation of speech because they have a very weird value set and they've grown up in bubbles and they just don't understand people with other values. So they shut down the wrong stuff a lot. They just make all kinds of unforced errors because they're just too biased and they can't see it. So there might be ways of regulating the tech companies in ways where, you know, before you demonetize someone on YouTube or before you shut, you know, permanently ban someone from Twitter, there has to be some sort of review. Now that would slow things down a lot and could be corrupted in itself. So I'm spitballing. But the main things you want are, I think, to increase the price of social punishment and to increase the cost of shutting someone down entirely of permabans.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't mind, I mean, let me just ask a question sort of in a
but I don't know how to think about it yet.
In a more abstract way, because I don't have to get into the weeds of some of this stuff. But I guess my question is, let's imagine that government regulation, coercion increases trust more than letting people be free to associate as they wish. Yeah. I mean, there would seem to be a tension there in your view. And I just wonder how you sort of navigate that. How do you think about policies that reduce freedom in that way and maybe violate norms of public reason, but yet empirically increase trust? I mean, maybe that's a null set, you know, that actually doesn't exist, like, because public reasons, norms, and the empirics like line up perfectly. But I would be surprised if that were true.
They don't line up perfectly.
Okay, so how do you think about that category of things?
Immigration might be one where there's a conflict, might be. That's the main one where I think there might be a conflict. But the first is to make sure, is there really a conflict, right? Like, before we go and coerce people, like, we need to be convinced that it will help. But then the public justification constraint comes in and says, okay, well, what do we want to just maximize trust? Is that all we care about? Well, no, it's not all we care about. We care about people being trustworthy. And that means that their trustworthy behavior has to come from their own moral conviction. It's very hard to force people to be trustworthy because if they're acting on the wrong reasons, then as soon as they can escape the government regulation, they're going to stop engaging in the relevant behavior. So part of the sort of conceptual case for a free society is that trustworthiness, to some almost conceptually, has to come from the heart. It's very hard to convert coerce that. So it's just going to be, it's going to be difficult to force people to be more trustworthy. What you want to do is kind of like punish people more for not following norms they already accept. If they're norms they already accept, then they're compatible with the public justification principle. So part of the thought is just that, you know, you want trust to be based on trustworthiness, but trustworthiness is something that is kind of resists heavy-handed coercion. But on top of that, there is just the fact that within relations of trust, respect for persons has certain requirements, and among those are public justification within the trust relationship. And so I think among people who trust each other, that to use coercion in those cases would count as a wrong. Given how I relate the relationship of trust to public justification. So there's three answers.
Okay. That's good. Yeah. Let's shift over to talk about, the free market and the welfare state, which you take up in two different chapters, but I thought, you know, could sort of talk through them at the same time, but, just say a little bit about how, you know, the free market facilitates social trust. There's a way in which, you know, sort of economic growth we've already talked about can produce political trust, right? People, when you get more bounties in society, that makes it easier for people to trust one another. When the pie is much smaller, people start fighting over it, right? When you get bigger pie,
Well, I mean, it's actually a little complicated with respect to growth because it looks like social trust doesn't go up when you get higher growth rates or when you get wealthier. Like Sweden's gotten much wealthier, but it's like its social trust is the same. But it does look like social trust promotes growth because more people can exchange. It's also easier in higher trusting countries to form institutions that make people more economically productive, like effective schooling. But there's a lot of new work on how trust generates growth, whether it's direct or whether it's institutionally mediated. But growth can improve political trust quite a bit.
Yeah, but it's also not just growth, right? On your view, it's also just the
Yes, way it has to be equal
capitalism
to
some structure. Yeah. Go ahead. So go ahead. Yeah, take it away.
Yeah. So with markets, what I'm talking about is not low taxes. Okay, I'm talking about legal property rights. So do you know where your property titles are? Can you go to small claims court or, you know, have a tort against somebody, right, when they damage your property? Can you get a mortgage, right? Can you invest? Can you get a savings account, right? Can you predict what the government's tax rates are going to be? So these are all like legal property rights. So I'm not talking about like libertarian property rights. Okay? I'm talking about legal property rights. And what these are able to do is they create stable norms where people can have positive exchange experiences. So people can interact and say, okay, you know, these are people, I have no idea who they are, but they sell me food and I'll eat it. Because, you know, it's probably fine. I trust these people, you know, they're not going to sell me poison food. So that's one way in which markets help to create trust, is people being able to stably and predictably have positive sum interactions with other people. So that's one thing. With respect to the welfare state, the big issue is economic security. One is just people feel like they can just sort of predict how their lives are going to go. One thing I didn't get into the book is some extremely recent empirical literature suggesting that adults' social trust can go down due to what's called unemployment scarring. So when people are unemployed for long periods of time, and I think it's that. So what I've been thinking now is a concept that I've just been developing called social betrayal. So it's the sense that people have that society doesn't value them, the society has betrayed them, society has failed them, right? And I think what unemployment scarring does is it creates a sense of social betrayal, which reduces social trust. But I just invented the term, and I don't know if it corresponds to anything in reality or whether it can be measured or anything. But I
Hegel has this notion of what he calls the rabble, der Pöbel, which is a very similar kind of idea. It's the underclass that enjoys no recognition from the public institutions of society.
You're right about that. So yeah, it's a failure of recognition, and then that creates resentment. So in the case I'm talking about, it's the fail to confer certain kinds of believed entitlements, right? So like, I should be able to get a job in my society that allows me to feed my family, right? And if I can't, you know, my society should be blamed, right? Like not just politicians, like society. I think a certain level of economic security is good to avoid the sense of social betrayal. But it's not clear that you need like really huge programs where you redistribute from the middle class to the middle class and stuff like that. But it's also the case that if you have programs just aimed at the poor, they can create more resentment and distrust in some cases because people think, I can't trust those poor people, we're wasting all their money on blah, blah, blah.
Right. You sort of make a case for more universal programs.
Yeah. I do think you need more universal programs and for a lot of reasons. One is the middle class and upper class people, if things start to get corrupt, they're going to know who to get on the phone with and start complaining. And they're invested in those institutions working well. And that makes them work better. I think they can be wasteful in certain ways because, of course, those people don't need the money. But the overall effect of creating economic security, I think, is pretty important. It also makes people more comfortable deregulating markets because they're not going to get thrashed about and ruined in the market, chewed up in the market process, because they can always fall back on something. So I can see the new child tax credit expansion. I can see that be trust increasing because there's a lot of people. You know, my wife's a marriage and family therapist who works with at-risk youth. She's seen a lot of poverty, grinding, terrible poverty. Their parents do waste a lot of whatever money they have, but a lot of it's out of just a sense of desperation. And that couple extra $100 a month per kid received monthly, could make a really, really big difference in their lives. So their sense of being left behind by their society may be reduced, right? Because, you know, now at least every month they're going to be able to put food on the table. You know, and I mean, food, the food subsidies are not crazily low in the United States by any means, but, you know, being able to pay for other things helps them pay rent, helps them pay down some debt, you know, those kinds of things. So that may increase economic security. I mean, I don't think we needed all the stimulus that we had, but expansion of child tax credits, the kind of thing that I think could be trust increasing.
Yeah, and so that, I mean, that points to, that particular example points to my next question, which is about tying these, tying welfare to work or to labor. So what do you make of the sort of challenge to universal welfare programs like child tax credit, or say, you know, I mean, the policy about an unconditional basic income, where you have the problem about sort of disincentives to actually work? I've seen a New York Times article just the other day about, you know, it's just like some of these lower status service jobs are just having a difficult time finding. Finding waiters.
Unemployment because benefits are too generous right now.
You don't want to pay people not to work very long. That's the worry, right? Part of the problem can point towards a decline in social trust because these sorts of welfare programs might be perceived as a way to just milk the system and be a sort of parasite. I don't know what people would say, but there are some
people who feel that very way. But what matters a lot is who the program is targeted toward and how and whether it functions that way. The genius of the child tax credit is helping kids. You know, that's pretty popular. People may say, oh, their parents are wasted on booze and drugs. But if you say, oh, no, actually, the kids are eating a little bit better. They're getting some more healthy calories a day. You know, it's easier for them to get to school. They can pay for doctor's visits a little bit more. Maybe Medicaid isn't doing enough for them or whatever. And you say, okay, I mean, they're using it for the children rather than just an unconditional basic income, which I do think would create an enormous amount of resentment. So really what you want to do is reduce child poverty. And you want to help the disabled. And then when it comes to adults who are able-bodied, if they have access to education, then they do have to sink or swim to a large extent. You want to protect them from ridiculously stupid large risks, you know, like, you know, getting in a car wreck and then getting horribly injured, not being able to pay for it. But I think you can do that without universal health insurance. You can do that with universal catastrophic health insurance.
Yeah, right.
So the people who can't help themselves, I think it's pretty popular to help them. But then when it's people who are perceived as being able to help themselves, then it becomes a source of resentment. So you do have to be careful how you structure the program, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, that norm of reciprocity, I think that would be what would undergird a lot of people's moral evaluations of this policy, right? If you're able-bodied, you need to contribute like others do. If you have a policy that allows for no reciprocity to occur, then that could lead to more mistrust, right?
Yeah,
I can see that. Yeah, good. So I'm going to get to your next chapter, which I found really interesting on, which is entitled "Against Egalitarianism," which is a great chapter on. You come from the perspective, you know, affirming free market, but also affirming welfare state. But you argue that there's a point where the policies of the left go too far and may actually, be a challenge to social trust. So I thought maybe we could just sort of walk, at what point do some of the policies, say, about income inequality, redistributing income, become a problem?
So the main case of going beyond to having redistribution aimed at producing equality and not just reducing poverty or suffering, right? So the kind of capitalist welfare state I like is where the state acts so as to reduce intense, needless suffering, right? Health, you know, through bad health, you know, malnutrition. You know, those kinds of things. And I think they should oftentimes use markets to do that instead, you know, but they can redistribute wealth like with a, you know, privatized social security system or something like that. But then the question becomes, well, should we redistribute more for reasons of equality? And I argue that, well, we're not going to get more social trust out of that, even though a lot of trust researchers think that we will. I don't think the Piketty story, we're getting more a redistribution, is going to save democracy because of his story. But I do think the Martin Gillen's work, where if you get too much inequality,
then people only respond to the top 10%, and the legislators only respond to that. That's worrisome. But I talked with Gillens a little bit about this over email, and it's not clear redistribution will get it back. So maybe you want to do some preemptive redistribution to prevent there from being too much economic inequality to sort of preserve democratic functioning. But that I prefer to do that through reductions in coercion rather than increases, right? So one of the reductions in coercion is, again, this real estate reform that I keep harping on, which would redistribute a massive amount of wealth. It would close the wealth gap much better than a lot of income taxation, because people have found that a lot of the increase in inequality that Piketty's talking about, when it isn't illusory, is due to increasing inequalities in real estate holdings and not increasing inequalities in income. So there's coercion reducing ways to preemptively reduce equality. And for that stuff, I'm good for it. But what if we go even further and we start to look at these two kinds of radical economic leftism that aren't pure command economy authoritarianism? And there's two options. One is property owning democracy, where the government puts a kind of upper limit and a lower limit on asset ownership. So, one thing here would be to force corporations to be more worker owned, to heavily tax capital so some people can't have too many assets. And I think these kinds of things invite so much corruption and reduce growth so much that it's going to be worse for trust overall in terms of government functioning, but also in terms of wealth production and creation. But then there's an even more radical regime, liberal socialism, which says that the means of production should be socially owned but operated by a democracy. I don't think that's stable, because people disagree too much about what the government should do to even agree on a central plan, which is why basically every actually socialist regime, meaning government ownership of the means of production, was not liberal or democratic. That's not an accident. But if you could have liberal socialism, but again, our ability to agree on them and the wealth reducing effects would just be really, really big. And there's new sources of conflict would be really big. So we should look at seriously some preemptive redistribution to make sure that democracy isn't totally central control. But since I wrote the book, I have encountered some really interesting work on campaign finance reform that suggests some very liberal reforms that I think would help. So right now, you don't see very much corruption where corporations are paying politicians to pass policies. There's way less of that than people on the left often think. But here's something that does go on that doesn't show up in the data very well unless you look really hard, which is paying people to keep things off the agenda so that they're never voted on. So it's not so much corporations pushing a tax cut. It's more than behind the scenes saying, hey, maybe this is what's going on. People will hire you when you leave office, or your family or whatever, just make sure this bill doesn't come up for a vote. You can hide that, right? And what it suggests is going on at the state level and the federal level is that you want campaign finance reform for people who control the agenda, who set agendas. So for instance, I think, there should be like a 5-year gap between when a speaker of any house or any Senate majority leader leaves office and can take a private sector job. Because 5 years is a long time, right? So it makes that promise a lot more. It's also the case that there should be regulations on the power of agenda setters, where there's a lot more limitations on them being able to just not have bills come up. So where, for instance, there has to be like the Senate majority leader doesn't control everything, like maybe 10 senators have to determine what comes up for a vote or something like that. So there are ways, I think, of reducing the effects of inequality, because what happens is you get really rich people and really rich groups who are able to keep things off the agenda. But you can reform the agenda setting process directly, and then the economic inequality won't matter as much. There's lots of ways, I think, to insulate the democratic process from big money that don't involve massive redistributions of wealth.
Yeah, well, some of the stuff you bring up is very interesting, and I've spent some time talking to people on this podcast about so the deliberative democracy side of things, where you can have deliberative polls.
Certain contexts.
Certain contexts, right? I mean, you can't go full autocratic. I had Ellen Landmore on. I know that you don't go that far, but as a sort of counterweight in public opinion against corporate views. I mean, to have a kind of informed deliberative assembly can be helpful. I mean, what do you think about, I thought when you were going to say campaign finance reform, you're going to talk about sort of public financing of elections. I mean, because
I don't know how much that will help. I would really like it if we could get past a two-party system. So if you could really fund third parties, you even still have first past the post. I mean, you would need to have a parliamentary system. We would depolarize a lot if it wasn't just red versus blue, I think. But as far as like deliberative institutions, I don't think most people have an incentive to deliberate. And I don't think there's any way to get them to do it, even if you coerce them. What you want is deliberation at the policy level to be improved. And that is a small enough number of people to where, you know, deliberative incentives can really help. Now, I'm also not a guy who's against bargaining. Like, I'm less worried about deliberation and just positive interactions between politicians. But I also think there should be more public input. So one thing is, I think there should be advisory deliberative bodies, small deliberative bodies that are autocratic in the sense that they are randomly selected from the populace. You know, it's like jury trials. There are structured rules of deliberation. But here is my trick that Landowar wouldn't like, or maybe she would like it. I'm not sure. Where do they get their information? Where do they get their information about, like, well, if we change X, well, what would be the effect? Well, I want them to use prediction markets and super forecasters. So, you know, intensely effective epistemic institutions that make use of markets and decentralized networks in order to get good information. So you get deliberation without the fake news, right? The really top-notch information sources. And then they make certain kinds of recommendations. And then those, because they're a representative sample of the population, can hopefully be taken up and be seen as things that the politicians ought to listen to. I'm on the fence about whether politicians should be forced to listen to them or not. I'm not really sure, because I worry that if there's too much force, then, you know, people will resent the fact that their elected officials are being held to these deliberative bodies that they didn't elect. So I don't know. I'm hopeful that we could get these consulting bodies off the ground. And they'd have authority because they're representative.
Yeah, good. And, you know, to shift from the sort of government side of things to the back to the corporate side of things, I mean, I wanted to push back just a little bit, or I don't know if this is exactly pushing back, but on the sort of the calls to democratize corporations. I mean, I sense that, you know, some sort of skepticism from your side of things. At the same time, I can kind of understand. I could definitely understand the motivation for it, which is, I mean, one of the effects, I think, of the rising inequality in America and sort of Western capitalism writ large in the past 30 years has led to a real mistrust, I think, of capitalist organizations themselves, right? That they seem to be, you know, sort of these distant plutocrats that don't, you know, can sort of prey on the weak and vulnerable. And, you know, sort of one way to fight against that, I assume, is to give, you know, is to democratize these institutions, to give more, say, worker control over capital. But maybe you don't even need to go that far. I mean, you can have sort of more worker representation on the board, like they do in Germany, for example. So, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't know if one needs to go as far as liberal socialism, right, to make this case. I think you talk about Abraham Singer, who's also on this podcast for his book, which is a, you know, very sensible view, right, to kind of try to marry the free market approach with trying to democratize in some ways.
Yeah, by liberal socialism, I mean government ownership and operation of capital. I don't mean having, you know, more unions and stuff.
Like I think
that, you know, as long as you don't have like union shop where everyone has to be a member of a union, I think we should radically deregulate the forming of unions as part of freedom of association. So I would like there for to be more unions. As far as the government intervening to create more worker ownership on boards, it's like that's not like really an increase in coercion, because it's just restructuring corporate law. And that's just a matter of like, it's not obviously an increase in coercion to rearrange those policies, right? Because workers don't have input. And so they're already kind of being pushed around by their bosses. To have them have more regulate, like to have them have a greater voice, you know, that's not necessarily an issue. Part of my worry is just more economic. I mean, workers tend to be pretty conservative, and you really want businesses to take risks. And I think, you know, Germany's economy does pretty well, but I think a lot of countries benefit from all our innovation. So you really, the more workers control, the more conservative they're going to be because, well, better not take a risk because I'm about to retire, mm-hmm. right? You know, or if they're young people, they say, you know, well, I would really like to save some income because I'm going to leave, take it with me. So, I mean, I just don't think that worker ownership has the right incentives, but having more worker representation, I mean, you know, I can entertain that. I can entertain that. I don't think that's necessarily out of the toolkit of an open society to have more worker representation among firms. It's just, you can go too far. But having more of a balance than we have, I don't really see a big problem with that. I mean, I actually think even a lot of libertarians, if you really follow the principles, don't necessarily have an issue with that because of the way corporations are structured, or just kind of state creation in a way that other kinds of property are not, like human property. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think about Elizabeth Anderson's book, Private Government, yep. right? Which is a, you know, why do we allow for, you know, sort of essentially authoritarian regimes within our midst, which we call corporations, where you can be sort of fired for any reason?
She just doesn't take exit rights seriously enough. I mean, the fact that you can leave is not trivial, mm-hmm. But with a stronger, more consistent welfare state, lower cost to unionization, reduced cost of starting new businesses, things more like decoupling healthcare from your job, which you can do in a number of different ways, just increase worker mobility, right? Reducing zoning laws by people to work in more places. There's a lot of things you can do to increase the power of leaving an association's ability to keep it from being terrible. And I think she underestimates the ways that we can improve our ability to exit and put pressure on bad and oppressive organizations. But yeah, I mean, I think the workers in Alabama, Amazon should be forming a union. I think Amazon treats its citizens like garbage. And I think that it morally shouldn't, and that people should criticize it for how it treats its floor workers. You know, like, or like its truck drivers that have to pee in bottles, literally. I mean, yeah, that's inhumane, you know? Yeah, maybe I have to wait a few more hours to get some stuff, but that is a kind of coercive violation that can't be justified. You know, that's a policy that leads to unjustified coercion, because basically people are being harassed and bossed. The question is, you know, what policies do that the best? And then you have to put it through what I call my policy epistemology filter. Like, you need evidence that these changes are going to do some good, but in those cases, I don't know how hard it is to tell that you could improve that situation. So yeah, this is a book that defends markets, but it's not a libertarian book.
Yeah, good. And you have a couple more chapters, which, you know, since time's running short, I just want to, you know, mention, and I didn't think we have time to talk about them, but, you know, but that democratic constitutional government and a certain form of electoral democracy are both institutions that you talk about vis-a-vis sort of the governance side of the government side, to increase political trust, which very, very interesting chapters. I wish we had time to talk about. I mean, I mainly wanted to zoom out here close to the end, Kevin, and just sort of ask, I mean, just step back kind of and ask the question, you know, return to the polarization, growing mistrust in America. And I guess just ask you to sort of bring what we've talked about back to bear on that question. So is it the case that, so let's say, you know, you're king of the world for a second. I mean, what a king of America, since this is very American. So what is it that about the, you know, do you find that these institutions are in jeopardy, and so we need to bolster the rule of law in order to, and that would lead to reduced polarization? Go ahead.
We have to reduce democratic norm erosion. And Trump was a really powerful threat to that. And I'm working on a paper now with some co-authors trying to explain the concept in an operationalizable way so that we can start measuring norm erosion better. And Biden, I think, has done a lot of good in this regard. I've actually been kind of surprised. But you know, how quickly he's kind of gotten things going. But there is this bill before Congress right now, some of which is really good and some of which is not, called H.R. 1, the For the People Act. And it's got a number of anti-corruption measures that I think will make Trump-like politicians harder to come into office in a way that's perfectly acceptable. So like requiring that you release your tax returns if you're a president, vice president, or in a high office, right? So if you've engaged in corrupt business practices in your life, it will be easier to detect, right? So there's a lot of, and also the lengthening of the time between when you can be in office and then go into the private sector, you know, something like that. So you want a lot of those kinds of restrictions on officials. You know, there's lots of different ways that the rule of law can get corrupted, but a lot of it I think is with bad agenda setting right now, is something that I'm focused on, which I talked about earlier. I think one of the main things I care about now, if I had a wand, I mean, I would change this to a parliamentary system where, you know, we could get more parties because people could vote for their party. And if they get 30% of the vote, they get 30% of the seats. That would help a lot with breaking up a lot of the red versus blue, because then there'd be third and fourth groups, which I think would help. But as far as improving social trust, a lot of the changes have to be cultural. But we need to find ways of lowering the stakes of politics so that the incentives to sort in these groups are reduced, because there's not as much point. And that does mean limiting government in various kinds of ways, although it will require it expanding or centralizing it in other ways. So it's sort of complicated, depending. Yeah.
I mean, in a way, this is what, you know, I wanted to get to, is your abstraction from cultural norms. In a way, I mean, one of the things I was surprised by, you know, in your book, that trust is, you know, you focus on institutions of civil society and institutions of government, but culture is missing, right? Shared cultural norms. I think, you know, like Tocqueville talks about religion as a bulwark and a unifying force, but you don't have to go so far as religion, but, you know, like the bourgeois norms and bourgeois virtues, say, of self-reliance and so forth. Or even, you know, like patriotism, for example. I mean, these are all, I guess you could say, arguably cultural forces that could be an answer to polarization, a way to bring folks together. Do you think that those things are not necessary, or that they would be like produced through institutional reform? What's your view on the sort of cultural?
We don't know enough to say much. The main thing that we do have evidence for is that there is a clear correlation between Protestantism and social justice. We don't know why, really. I'm inclined to think that the weird story for Joe Henrich that I told explains both more trust and more Protestantism. But we don't really know. Cross-cutting identities, I think, would help. So I think religiosity helps with that a lot, because then people have something to care about other than politics. But it's already the case that religiosity is being pretty polarized and being eaten by the red versus blue dynamic. So I don't know if more religiosity is going to help with that problem or not. What would be nice is if you had more cross-partisan religiosity, but that kind of like assumes we've already solved the problem. So I don't know. So that's why I didn't say more.
Well, maybe you could explain. I mean, you say in the conclusion, I have not defended liberalism as an ideology or an ethos in this book. Indeed, I reject that ethos. I mean, maybe you could explain that, because I found that to be a surprising that you would. I mean, maybe you could say like I'm surprised to say that here that you reject it rather than sort of you know, maybe saying something like, this is not a matter for public regulation, or, you know, would be up to your private judgment. But that you reject it was, I guess, surprising. Maybe you could say a little bit about why.
Sure. I'm a fairly theologically orthodox Christian. And I think that the kind of liberal ethos that celebrates autonomy above all else is destructive. I think there are higher, more transcendent values, and that the ultimate aim of all our striving should be union with the divine. And so in that sense, I don't share the liberal ethos of you know, incessant social progress and autonomy above other things. Now, I don't know how real that is. All I'm trying, or if that's just a caricature, but what I'm trying to convey in saying that is that I'm not defending liberalism because I'm a liberal all the way down. I'm defending liberal rights practices. I'm defending liberal order. But I don't have the liberal ethos. I mean, I like equality between people, but I don't think about it in the same way as other people do. But the main thing is just that my priorities are different. I do think a lot of the stuff that religious critics say of American society are true, that we are too individualistic there, we are too consumeristic, that we are not as focused on higher things that actually matter, that we have, for in too many ways, forgotten the importance of an objective moral order. We're too quick to dismiss tradition. I buy a lot of that at the margin anyway. I mean, I don't think it's as obviously or forcefully true as many people do, but I mean, I think there's a lot to it, but I don't think that has very much to do, or hasn't been shown to have very much to do, whether we have constitutional order. I am partial to the old fusionist conservative line that, you know, the non-liberal religious culture does help to undergird the liberal order, constitutional order. That may be true, I just don't know. I would like to have, it would be better to have good data on this. Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, to some extent, I think liberal order helps to produce more religiosity because you get more sincere religiosity when you don't have a state religion. So in one way, more liberalism might mean more religiosity rather than more religiosity making me more liberalism. I don't know. Hard to say. Seems like liberalism is doing pretty well in secularized Western Europe.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's a question to end with.
I'm not excited about secularization, just to say, but liberalism seems to be doing okay. So I don't want to just say, look, all the things I like go together. You know, like people do that all the time. It might just be false. Maybe all the things I like don't go together.
Right. Well, and maybe this is a question that, you know, you mentioned super forecasting. I mean, maybe you could forecast liberalism for us. I mean, do you see it heading in the direction of America or heading more in the direction of Europe?
Depends on the country a lot. It depends on demographics. Who's having kids and who isn't? Those are long run things that are going to matter. A lot of it will depend on how we handle mass immigration and the expectations of assimilation that we have. It's going to depend on preventing norm erosion in the United States. How much we keep liberalism, but we really need to look at trying to avoid basic national unity on a new in-group, out-group. And both the illiberal left and right are proposing that we do this. The right would like who's the real America and who isn't, and the left is who's for equality and who's the enemy of equality, right? So we have to really resist the recreation of tribes and the exacerbation of in-group, out-group thinking. And you would normally think that folks on the left would be all on board with that. And many of the older folks on the left are. But it's the younger folks on the left that I think really want to play the in-group, out-group game, want to play the good guys, bad guys game. And that's the kind of thing I really don't like. And then my Christianity just backs that up because, you know, we're all brothers and sisters in Jesus. We all ought to love each other and have some mercy and forgiveness and try to think the best of each other and not be mean and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Not that Christians always do that, but that's the view. So, you know, boy, I like forgiveness a lot. And we're just forgetting how to do that. Yeah, I think we need more concern with reconciliation, peace, but really, really resisting the culture of good guy, bad guy, friend, foe.
Good. Well, let's hope that that comes to pass, Kevin.
Just depends on us now.
So. Yeah, it's up to us. Good. Well, thanks so much for this great conversation, Kevin, and joining me again on the Political Theory Review.
Yeah, well, it was a lot of fun.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.